chromosomes. Little strands of nucleic acids and proteins are the fundamental genetic instructions that tell us who we are at birth. Most people are born with 46 chromosomes, but each year in the United States, about 6,000 people are born with an extra chromosome, making them a person with Down syndrome. If you've ever encountered someone with Down syndrome, you know that they are some of the kindest, most joyful people you will ever meet. They truly have something extra. My name is Lisa Nichols, and I have spent the last 24 years as both the CEO of Technology Partners and as the mother to Allie. Allie has something extra in every sense of the word. I have been blessed to be by her side as she impacts everyone she meets. Through these two important roles as CEO and mother to Allie, I have witnessed countless life lessons that have fundamentally changed the way I look at the world. While you may not have an extra chromosome, every leader has something extra that defines who you are. Join me as I explore the something extra in leaders from all walks of life and discover how that difference in each of them has made a difference in their companies, their families, their communities, and in themselves. I'm thrilled to have Melissa Harrison on the show today. Melissa is the Vice President of Member Engagement and Discipleship at CEO Forum and a former television news and anchor reporter. If you like this episode today, please go to Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen and leave us a 5-star rating. Well, Melissa, I have been looking forward to this time with you so much because I just think you're the most amazing person. You and I got connected through CEO Forum. And I will tell you, the first time I met you, I knew I adored you. And now we have just gotten to know each other more and more, and that affection for you has just grown. So thank you so much for making the time to be on the show. And I know you're traveling today and things are crazy. So I appreciate you carving out some time.
Absolutely. Absolutely, Lisa. And that admiration is very mutual. I loved getting the chance to visit you in St. Louis and being able to come and just seeing, you know, more. I'd heard so much about you and about your podcast and your story and your heart and how incredible you are and all the incredible roles that you, the different roles that you lead in your life. But it was so fun for me to initially meet you. And then over this past, I guess, year and a half almost, to get to know you. And I'm so grateful and honored to be here today.
Yeah. Well, it's like I told you this morning, I know one thing's for sure. Your story is just going to impact our listeners. And I know, secondly, I know you and I are going to have fun because we always have fun and we laugh a lot, right? When we're
together. Most important.
But you know, here's what I would love to talk about. I mean, you are brilliant. There's no doubt about it, Melissa, you're brilliant, but you're also very humble. You're also a very caring and compassionate person. And I see this in you. But you know, like a lot of us, and I don't want to focus totally on this, but I know that you've gone through a lot of pain in your life. And you know, I think that knowing your story now and knowing the pain that you have gone through, I think that's probably why you are such a compassionate and empathetic person. And we're going to talk about that. But, you know, why don't you take us back? Because I found out some things recently about you that I didn't even know. I didn't even know were part of your story. But why don't you take me back to your childhood? And you grew up, I believe, in Grand Prairie, Texas.
That's right. Grand Prairie, Texas.
I love Texas. Everything's bigger in Texas.
Yeah.
Love the people of Texas. But take us back to your childhood and tell us a little bit about growing up and your story.
Yeah. So I was adopted into a family in Grand Prairie. My mother and father, my adopted mother and father, who are my mother and father to me, they adopted me. I was almost 2 years old. I had been in foster care in Dallas County and had been given up for adoption. Actually, have recently in the past couple of years discovered more about my story that I was actually taken into CPS custody because my birth mother was facing some very significant challenges. And so I was placed in the foster care system. The way it works in foster care is the goal is to unite the child, to reunite them with the birth family if it's a safe place. And so I was put in this path of the foster care system where I was kind of in a temporary space between my birth family, birth mother, and being put up for adoption. And that lasted a full 365 days. So this is all things in my parts of my story that I've just recently discovered too through DNA testing, which, you know, that's a whole other conversation of how these test kits are opening up so much information and unlocking so much about people's history. But the story that I knew growing up from my parents who adopted me was that my mommy, who gave birth to me, couldn't take care of me. And so my parents wanted a baby so badly that they adopted me. And so I always felt that overwhelming sense of love. In no way was my adoption story a shock or something that made me feel less than. I was always told that I was so special that they had wanted me. And I felt that to my core. I feel that to my core today, even in spite of the challenges of my life pre going into that home and after. There is such an overwhelming sense of love and knowing that I am deeply loved. And I think what that's taught me so much now as an adult is that when children feel that, it is transformative through their upbringing, any challenges they face in life, having that love. And so I was adopted into this family, and my parents had both lived in Grand Prairie, both moved there from elsewhere in Texas, like in their grade school years. They were high school sweethearts, got married. And the generational families in our town were really, there was something really special about that because my grandparents helped found a church in the town when they first moved there, brought a pastor from East Texas where they had lived previously, where my mom was born. And they were really a part of this church community from my grandparents being friends with families and then their kids being my parents' generation and then their children being my generation, that we all kind of grew up together and did life together. And so what I really saw in that very middle class, small town was just a communal love and investment in people's lives. People knew each other, people were invested. And it wasn't a tiny town. It wasn't that everybody in town knew each other. It was more the way I saw my grandparents, my parents investing in the community. And so that was really, really beautiful. Grew up there. We adopted a younger brother. I'd always wanted a brother or sister, adopted a younger brother when I was 8 years old. And I went on to have a pretty, I don't know, it's funny when you have children, you wonder like, what are they going to think is normal and what's not? And I think when we're kids, whatever our childhood is, that's normal to us. For me, it felt like a very normal upbringing. And so I did that until I went off to college, went to Baylor University, which is where I went to school.
Right. Yeah. I want to talk about that. So yeah, that is, I love so much of what you said. And I know that community, and we'll talk about this because it's kind of what you're doing today, you know, in your current role is building community. So you've had other times, and we'll talk about this. So seeing that community and that strong communal feel,
right,
you know,
right,
carried forward for you, Melissa, and even how you operate today. So I love it. And then the other thing that I really love that you said is just you never questioned that love. You felt wanted. Yeah, I mean, honestly, you were chosen. It wasn't even like, you know, I mean, it wasn't like, oh, wow, we're pregnant. I mean, it's like you
right.
were chosen. How special is that?
It really is. And, you know, we have three children. I have three young children. And I wondered in the back of my mind if I'm able, I wanted to be able to have biological children. I had never seen somebody that I looked like. I'd never had a blood relationship with somebody that I knew. And I wanted to have that and experience. And I wondered, am I going to have that and then discover that it's a deeper bond genetically? How will I feel? Will it be a different love? And what's really interesting, and I've heard other adoptive children talk about this and parents who've adopted, it is interesting how it feels just as strong, if not potentially even stronger, because there was such a recognition that there was something missing and the willingness to go to great lengths to get it. And just an appreciation that I think we can often take for granted if having children could come quickly and easily. Sometimes we may not realize the journey some people have had to go through to get there.
That's right. That's so beautiful. I love so much about that. But let's go on. Let's talk about, because you did go to Baylor. Go Bears.
You know, go Bears.
You got your bachelor's in communications, I believe, and Spanish and communications from Baylor. But I have to ask you a question.
Yeah.
Did you ever meet Chip and Joanna?
I never met them. You know what's so funny? They have transformed Waco. I mean, when I went to school at Baylor, it's like nobody would come visit that went to my friends from for us here in Texas. University of Texas is big, Texas A&M. You know, if I wanted to see any of my friends from high school or who went to other colleges, I had to get on the road and drive because nobody was coming to Waco. Right. And, you know, to see now, we have family in the Seattle area through my husband's side of the family. They're taking trips down just to see, you know, the silos and Chip and Joanna Gaines. I'm like, wow, that couple has transformed that town. Yeah. I think they were.
It's on my
school.
Bucket list. It's definitely on my bucket list.
Is it? Okay. You'll have to tell me when you come.
Okay, Melissa.
Yeah. They're a great couple. I did not know them at Baylor, but they were there about the same time that I was in college. Mm-hmm. So,
well, maybe we can meet them together. That would be
that'd
fun.
Be great.
But you started your career as a news producer. I just love the journalistic, you know, the story. You love a story. Yeah. And I love that about you. But you worked as a news anchor. I think you were in six different markets. Abilene, Jackson, Mississippi, Birmingham, DFW, and then New York. And I want to talk a little bit about New York, Melissa, because when you were in New York, you actually went and completed your master's at Columbia, you know, which is an Ivy League school. I mean, it's consistently ranked in one of the top spots. How was that? I know that the average acceptance rate at Columbia is about 6%.
Oh, wow.
So when I said you are brilliant, girl, you are brilliant, you know, but how was that being at Columbia at an Ivy League?
Well, you know, it's interesting because the journey there, I did a program, Joseph Pulitzer, who the Pulitzer Prize is named after, founded the Graduate School of Journalism at Columbia. And when he did, he made kind of this, he gave money to the school and said he would found it, but he had the stipulation that journalists should not major in journalist and undergraduate, their undergraduate education. They needed to have expertise in politics, economics, just really. And so the graduate school was really an interesting place to be because everybody in there had studied something else. For me, this something else was Spanish and international communications. I had really, my dream was to be a television news anchor, a reporter. And that came about actually in my middle class high school, public high school in Grand Prairie. There was a teacher who was just really passionate about good journalism and storytelling. And she just gave us this kind of simulated a working newsroom on that campus. And we had a studio. And to be honest, the program in my high school was better, I hate to say it, but then Baylor's was at the time. It was really good. And this teacher had such passion. And I knew back then at like 16, 17, 18, I was like, wow, if my job could be to go out and tell people's stories, to meet them, all kinds of walks of life, all different circumstances, but to tell their stories, that would be so much fun. So the road to Columbia was interesting because for a lot of fields, you would go from undergraduate directly to graduate school. In journalism, you don't actually even need graduate school. You really need the practical experience. That's what an employer is going to look at. And those first jobs out of the gate were, you know, $15,000 a year salaries in Abilene, which was funny at the time because I had my picture on billboards and buses. And yet I think technically I may have qualified for welfare assistance of some sort. So it's just so ironic. It was like people, you
things
have to
get out
of. Things
are not always what they seem, are
exactly.
they, Melissa?
Exactly. I'd go to the grocery store and they'd be like, we didn't know you do your own grocery shopping. You know, I was the evening anchor at the time. I'm like, oh my gosh, I can barely afford these groceries. So it's just so ironic. But the way that it works in that industry, you want to move up quickly. So you go to these middle of nowhere towns to get there. But you learn a lot through that. It's almost like I compare it almost to like playing minor league ball before you get to the big leagues. You make your mistakes in the smaller places, but there's a work ethic and a grit that you really have to survive that kind of, especially back then. Now with things streaming, with more opportunities online, there's more that people can do with less barrier of entry. But at that time, if you were going to get somebody to put you on television, you had to really prove yourself and fight to get there and stay there. And there was a lot of funny stories through the journey. So when I went to Columbia, it was really a decision to kind of step back from the day-to-day and to go and really dive deeper into some longer form storytelling. Television news is very, you're working in a very time, like the deadline pressure is off the charts. I mean, you daily are having, you have to be so nimble and able to respond to events in real time and try to beat competition and covering it. So there's just this intensity that can be very wearing. But also for me personally, I had been through a very difficult season and experience. And I knew that for my, I didn't even have the words for it at the time, but looking back, it was really a recognition that I needed some soul care. I needed to push a pause. I needed some time to kind of reflect on what I'm doing and why. And that's what Columbia offered me. The funny thing is, I mean, it was an honor to be there. It's considered one of the best or the best journalism school really in the world. But I, you know, will say that some of those stories I cover in Abilene and some of the things in Jackson, Mississippi, I mean, they may have been tougher than Columbia was, but it was a great opportunity to really connect. And in the media capital of the world, I mean, in New York City, it's really, yeah, if you can be there. And it is, I love New York. One thing we would do growing up is take these cross-country camping trips around the country. And my parents didn't have a lot of money, but they wanted to show us, really to show us the world, but what we could afford to do was camp. And we saw 46 of the 50 states by the time I was 16. I had not even been on an airplane yet. And I remember the first time we went to New York, just saying, I want to live here one day. And so Columbia was really the vehicle that got me there. Mm-hmm. And I loved it. Some people don't love New York. I really do love it.
Yeah. My assistant, whom you know, Jenny Hill, loves New York and lived in New York for a while. Oh, yeah. She loves the theater. And yeah, she loves New York, the Big Apple.
Yeah.
Wow. I love that story. I love your, that Columbia really was that chance to kind of take a step back. Because, I mean, Melissa, you and I have talked about this, and it is not easy to be in the limelight like that. You're mm-hmm. in the public eye, and you say you never want to let them see you sweat. So it's hard right. for you, like when you're carrying stuff, to always be in the public eye like that. And then secondly, you are always on. In fact, I have another really dear friend, Zipper Zappa, who was a sportscaster in many different markets. And, you know, he said really television kind of becomes your mistress is the way he said, because, you know, your hours are crazy a lot of times and there's not a lot of time for social. And
yeah.
I know that it's not an easy thing, but I want you to talk about, because when you were in New York, and this is kind of going back to your love for community, Melissa, you founded an organization, and I think it's called Pure Women's Ministry. You know, you've always had a heart for women, but that is an organization that you founded, maybe co-founded, I'm not sure. But what was the gap that you were seeking mm-hmm. to fill when you found that organization?
Yeah, well, you know, part of my story is before I moved to New York, I had been through a real tragic situation. My mom had actually been murdered, and it's a long story. But for me, when the thing that I loved about my role and my job was the storytelling, I find, you know, I really appreciate the power of a story, the transformation it can bring. But, you know, when you're telling other people's stories, it's so easy. And I really enjoy telling other stories more than my own, even to this day. There can be a discomfort in how do you wrestle with your own story and what it is. And especially for me at the time, it shattered an illusion that I had two areas of my life. One, professionally, you know, we would go into as news reporters into, I mean, I've been, you know, on drug busts, you know, with police officers. I've stood in the middle of a Category 5 hurricane reporting. I've been in a standoff whenever there are, you know, heavily armed militia people there ready to fire. And you always had this sense that all those situations, I felt bulletproof. I felt like there was something between me and the story, and that my role was to tell the story. I didn't do anything, I don't think, really reckless. If I felt unsafe, I would have left. But there was a wall between me and the tragedies I was covering or the risk that I was reporting mm-hmm. on. And I think when my own life, when this happened, I was 25 years old. And, you know, for me, it just early in my career shattered that illusion that bad things don't happen to good people, or that people like us couldn't be victimized or be impacted in a way that I always thought that happened to others. And so that was the first illusion. The second was, as a believer, I'm a Christian, and my faith, I think I felt very secure in that, as I talked about, that generational faith that was passed down, that I was adopted into that family, salt of the earth people, loved God, served the Lord, really beautiful. So all the seeds they had sown were good that I could see. And I just was shocked that something like this would happen, that God would allow it to happen. And I didn't know how to reconcile that. And I think for me, in my newsroom, it not only shattered my illusion, but my colleagues really rock their world too, because if that could happen to me, it could happen to them. And I think for all of us, it was a wake-up call. And I think when I went back into the newsroom, this was before I got to New York. I was working in Birmingham, Alabama, when my mom died. And they, you know, I had been on the big stories of the night. That was always kind of my thing. And all of a sudden, they wanted to send me on like cake bakes and all these things that were real second segment or something after weather at the end of the show, you know. And I'm like, guys, I can do this. But what it required was putting on a mask. It required separating my spiritual soul from my role. And in that separation that I learned to do to continue to perform in my job and my profession and not lose ground, I had worked so hard to climb up to that point, thinking to myself, I didn't go to Abilene and Jackson and Birmingham and Dallas to quit. Like, New York is my goal. And so I had really learned to live that way. And I think 2 years talking about your friend saying, television, if you work in that, could become your mistress. It can also become your identity, where even loved ones can be really impressed with what you're doing and think you're just fine because they see you on the news and you're smiling and you look fine, look like everything's okay. And it's when I got to New York and I was taking that pause and reflecting, and I looked around me and I thought, you know, who do I, first of all, I didn't know hardly anyone in New York, where in Dallas, where I'd come from, I knew a lot of people having grown up there. And I started looking around just thinking, who are quality people? How do you find quality people in New York that you can trust and build community with? And it was just, honestly, by the grace of God, I found a community through, it was called Priority Associates, and it was a workplace ministry, part of Campus Crusade. They had a vibrant workplace ministry. But the thing that I recognized was there was a lot for men in the city. There was that. There was another organization called the New Canaan Society that would bring in a retreat each year, maybe 800, sometimes 1,000 men for a conference to come together. But women I was meeting, and just so many incredible women, Lisa, like the women we know, women that we could just name all the women we know mutually, that you're like, my goodness, these women are incredible. They are a force. And I would say one of my giftings, if it is a gift, is being able to connect people, to be able to say, you should know this person and you should know that person. What was happening when I visited Priority Associates, even though most of the things were for men, there were a couple of co-ed groups, and we started saying, like, we should get something together just for the women, separate from this, just for us to be able to do life together and get to know one another. And these women were incredible, but what they had learned in New York in that environment was how to put the game face on and, you know, just go out into the world. And I mean, I'm sure
fine. Yeah.
Everything's fine. And New York is so hard. If you're going to get a cab, if you want a spot on the bus, if you want, you know, all the things, you got to fight for everything. And so these women, I recognized just a felt need for community and to be known. And so it was really fun to see. My suggestion was, and I got it from seeing my mom, she had a gift of hospitality, and she led the women's ministry at our church. And she was really a leader in our community and really a champion for women. She's somebody who never was intimidated that I could see. You know, she just didn't have an insecurity. It was more just how could she love and serve all kinds of women. And so it was funny in New York, I just had all of a sudden this desire to get this group together. And all of a sudden, and it was really funny because in New York, you have your small apartment, and some people, you may have heard this, Lisa, even use their ovens for storage. Like they use their ovens because you don't cook in your apartment.
Right.
So sometimes people put sweaters in their oven because you're running out of room. And so I just felt it to cook breakfast for them on Wednesday. At the time I was working at NBC, did not have time to be doing this, but I'd bake a casserole the night before, bring it in for our little study. We started meeting on Wednesday mornings. Priority Associates said, sure, use our space. That's great. Started meeting. Women in New York were so impressed. They thought I was a great cook. I mean, it was a simple casserole, but I didn't tell them.
Right.
But we started meeting and we met for a year. And there was a woman who had just graduated from Dallas Theological Seminary. And she started leading us through a Bible study. And I was still struggling with the Lord over what happened to my mom. I was processing, didn't really know how to do that in community. So I didn't share what had happened. And we played it pretty safe that first year. Nobody got too personal, but we were building community and relationship. And then that woman had to step down for the summer and she asked if I could lead. And since I was there each week and I knew that I was not in a place where I could do that, but I said, you know, let's have everybody share their story. And if we took turns each week sharing our story, then, and this is me using that journalistic, so let me hide behind this. This is my default. I can do this. I can, you know, and women started sharing their story. And what was really cool was it was about the third weekend, a woman just getting really personal. And she just said like, hey, we need to cut the crap. Like, you don't know me. I don't know you. She's like, you think I have it all together because I look like this? She's like, I got this down pat. Like I am covering up so much. And she was just very open and honest and shared that she had had an abortion in college and she had never been able to forgive herself. And she was afraid of judgment, especially in a faith community. And those women just wrapped their arms around her. But what happened to that group, as you can imagine, is then the depth and intimacy level
went off the charts. Yeah, it was probably a pivotal point. That was a pivotal point for the group, Melissa. Well, gosh, we've got so much more to talk about. And I do want to talk about your mom. I want to talk about that tragic day. I think it was October the 3rd. I want to say 1999 that happened. I want to talk about that. But we do need to take a quick break. And then we'll be right back with Melissa Harrison on the Something Extra podcast.
Hey there. In a challenging business climate like this, savvy leaders look to technology to find an edge. This can mean the difference between staying ahead of the curve or playing catch up. It's time to collaborate with the highly skilled experts at Technology Partners. Our team of technologists draws upon decades of experience for your project, with each bringing a passion for solving problems and a track record of success. How can we help you overcome your biggest technology challenges? Visit technologypartners.net to book a free consultation with one of our leaders.
So welcome back, everyone, to the Something Extra podcast with Melissa Harris. And Melissa, we still have so much to talk about. I seriously think you and I could talk for hours and hours and hours, but we're not going to do that to our listeners. But, you know, I appreciate you talking about this community that you built in New York. But, you know, you mentioned some tragedy. And I said at the very beginning, Melissa, you've been through a lot of pain in your life, starting at a very young age. It didn't, you know, it started out not so great, right? But I believe that is God used all of that to make you the person that you are today. And you are such a compassionate, empathetic person. But, you know, I love Brene Brown said this. I think it's attributed to her, but she says, one day you will tell how you overcame what you went through and it will become someone else's survival guide.
I love that. I love that.
I do too. I love that quote. And I believe that so much. But here you were, you were 25 years old. And I think you were in the Alabama, you were in the Birmingham market at the time, in the newsroom. And I remember you telling the story about you were hosting a dinner party, you know, and your team was blowing up your phone, you know, which was not unusual because to your point earlier, you had to be ready when there was an event happened, you had to jump on it, right? There's a story to tell. But this time it was different. And the story was about you. So why don't you and your family, why don't you tell us, our listeners, about the story? And the story is even as tragic as it is, and it's just awful, awful. But what you learned, it was even more tragic because of who was involved.
Yeah. So yeah, I was hosting a dinner party and we had pagers back then, 1999. So pager starts going off and, you know, that would always happen in the middle if I was on a date or had plans with girlfriends. I was like, of course, there's some 3-alarm fire I'm getting called into. So I just ignored it. And typically you wanted to be the first to respond because you wanted out of that market to a bigger market. So I thought, you know what, I'm having a party. I'm going to let somebody else have that call, get that story. And it was a couple of times later, the page coming through when it did say, Melissa, call the newsroom immediately. I knew then, I'm like, oh, wait, this is personal. This is not just an all-out page. So when I called, I could tell quickly something was not right. They said there was a man named Richard Oseguera, trying to get a hold of me from Grand Prairie. That's my hometown, but it was several hundred miles away. So I didn't know why this person would be trying to reach me. And later discovered through that conversation that police had discovered my mom, my mother, in our home in the entryway, and had found her. And it was, to say it was shocking, there's no words to really capture what happens in your mind when you find out something like that. There was a real sense in my mind that I wanted to keep my head. The first two words that I remember coming to my mind were stay sane. And it's so interesting because I think, why was that what I thought? But I think it may have been two things. One, I had been in that situation where I saw people finding out news like this and really lose it, faint, or all kinds of ways that they reacted. And I also think it was a real gift, truly a supernatural thing, that I had a real soundness of mind to be able to keep my presence and stay in the moment to be able to process what was happening. But later I discovered that my younger brother, who we had adopted, he was involved in a Christian school. My mom had taken him out of our public high school I went to and put him in a small Christian school. She said to me that summer, she said, you know, Melissa, Max is a follower and I'm afraid he's going to follow somebody and it's not going to have been his idea to go there, but he's going to end up in the middle of it. And she's like, I just want to put him in a more controlled environment. Max was also adopted. Done some research on adopted children. I love adopted children and stories, of course. There is a kind of a phenomenon that happens with adolescent male adoptees whenever they are around that 16, 17-year-old age, especially if there's something that triggers that, they can go through a season of feeling disconnected or kind of pushing back and rebelling. And I think that's what was happening. The problem is, the perfect storm was, Max became friends with this kid at his school who, it turns out, was very... Now we understand in today's context, he was mentally ill and he had had a lot of trauma, but they had this friendship and they had just made the wrong decisions that night to go to our house. My mom taught Sunday school. Max said, you know, my mom will be asleep. We can get some money. And they had been involved definitely in drinking, likely with drugs, but it was a quick spiral for Max. And I think that was, again, when we talk about those things, when they happen and how the ripple effect hits the community around, for our church community and our faith community, it was just shocking that Cindy Tamplin, of all mothers, that this would happen to. Our home was the home everybody went to after the football games and the youth group, and all the moms called her for advice on certain things. And so she was the resource. And it was heartbreaking for me to even understand my brother's involvement. It would take a long time. And I don't think, you know, really it's hard to go into graphic detail of what happened. But I think overall, Max's role was more of an accomplice, but per Texas law, just being present, you're equally responsible. And going there with the intent to get money was enough to commit a felony. And that, combined with somebody being murdered, even though it wasn't premeditated, the police don't believe either the boys had intended for it to happen. But again, it was just this moment, this storm, this, I mean, you know, just tragedy that happened. Mm-hmm.
Probably it just spiraled out of control. I mean, it spiraled into something that they really never intended.
Exactly. That adolescent not thinking about it.
He was 17. When it happened. Oh gosh, Melissa, it's just such a tragic story. So here you are dealing with the loss of your mom, who you're so close with. And your mom, certainly, I see a lot of your mom in you. You know, you said she was I think you said she was a great baker.
She was good at it.
baking, you know, but hey, you can make casseroles. So, you know, you must pick up something there, but just this whole love of women, so much of you in her, but then to find out that your little brother was involved and then basically lose him too, because what happened with him? What was the sentence?
Yeah. So Texas is a place where you do not want to make a mistake or anything. I mean, it is a harsh system and there are good and bad things about that. But in this situation, the sentence is, even if you didn't actually commit the crime, if you're there to rob somebody and this happened, you are sentenced to life in prison. So he is serving a life sentence. And yeah, I mean, it's a heartbreak, you know, it's interesting. I think our stories too. I remember after it happened, feeling like this can't be my story because this isn't who we are. I just kept feeling this is not a reflection of our home. And I think deep down as I covered stories, I've always wondered like what was going on behind closed doors, what could have led children to do that. It must have been really bad parenting, if only they had good parents, you know. So I think for me, this was really shocking. And as I'm now a parent myself and closer to the age my mom was when she died, I have a whole new level of empathy and appreciation for just what she was trying to navigate. Cause you know, we really can't control once our kids are old enough to get behind the wheel of a car and to make some decisions on their own in those adolescent years, and boys' brains are not fully developed and they are not thinking, but the consequences of this crime are long lasting, obviously.
Yeah. Cause so, your mom was only what, 51, was it? She must have said she's very young, very young. Very young. Well, I want you to talk about this because you and I, you know what kind of year we've had too. And I've learned more about grief and loss this year than I've ever known. How did you start to heal, you know, Melissa? And I'm sure there's not a day that goes by. It's not like you get through it. You know, right. You carry that person with you, right? Every single day. But, you know, what were some of the lessons about grief that you learned during that time?
Yeah. You know, I think my first approach to it, there was a lot going on because of the circumstances of her death. And there was a lot to, with me being the only child, essentially at that point, to take care of the estate. And we had two murder trials and all kinds of things. So the to-do list was long. And I felt like dealing with the death of my mother would be going through that list and checking off all the things from the funeral to the estate to, you know, all of the things that you need to do after somebody dies. And I honestly thought like that was part of the grieving. And of course, it was part of the grieving process. But it was interesting. About a year later, I had connected with a woman who was a counselor. I wasn't coming to her for counseling. I was meeting her through a Bible study at church. But she said to me, she said, "You need to do grief work. You need to process what's happened." And I was like, no, I've done all the things. Like, we have wrapped up this and this and this, and I have dealt with nothing. I think her term was, "You need to deal with your mother's death." And I'm like, lady, that is all I've been dealing with. Like, trust me, I'm doing everything possible. And she's like, no, because if you don't actually deal with what has happened, if you try to get over this instead of going through the grieving process, then grief will deal with you. Like, you either deal with it or it deals with you. And she went on to explain how so many people, so many ways that they deal with it or that it takes over for them, whether it's through addiction or compulsive eating or drinking, all the things that people do when they try to run away from their grief. So I think the thing that I learned that I didn't want to know, and even when I think of your year, Lisa, just when you say you've learned so many things about grief, and it's like all the things, in a way, you're glad to now understand, but you just wish you didn't have to learn it this way because it is so painful. And I think the unexpected nature always gets me. The, you know, as I study a little bit more about mother loss too, the whole idea of sometimes in my moments that should be the most joyful, I will get sad because I recognize she's not here. So whether it's the birth of my child, my wedding day, our first Christmas as a married couple, I'm in the bathroom in tears thinking, what is wrong with me? This is the day I've been waiting for. And what is this emotion that has overcome me? So I had really good counseling. I felt lonely for sure in my grief. And I think grief by nature is lonely because even in the same family, people grieve differently. So that's hard because even if you're all mourning the same loss, you're dealing differently. And so, and each person had a different relationship with that person. So that can be feel like you're losing your family dynamic too. And if the person you lost was the center or really the force behind all that, which my mom was, she was the glue that held so much of our family together. And I have grieved and continue to grieve the extended family and the loss of what would have been. I think that's the thing I'm grieving now is what would have, in my mind, should have been, is not. And now that I see for my kids, I think in this season, I'm more surprised at a little the level of anger that I have that I had not ever really experienced, even in spite of the circumstances. You know, I never got really angry. And now I just feel for their benefit and their sake, I feel like they have been robbed. You know, I recognize right. They were robbed. And like you said, I'm going out of town today for a meeting. And if my mom were alive, she'd be doting on those grandkids. She'd pick them up after school. She'd do the carpool. And they don't have it. And they won't ever really know what they don't have, but I know. And I think that's hard for me now to see that, dang it, it's been over 20 years and I'm still grieving. It never, you don't ever like graduate from the Institute of Grief. I wish you got to this point. You're finally graduate and you don't feel it anymore, but it doesn't.
You carry it. You carry it with you to your point. You know, when you have those moments of, you know, where it should be celebratory, you know, you think, oh, they're not here. Yeah, I know our grandson Sawyer was 18 months old, I guess, when my mom passed away. And my mom was an incredible woman too. Incredible. And I mean, that was the thing that just hurt my heart so much, Melissa, is like, I said, you're not going to know. He's not going to know my mom like I knew her and like my daughter. And so one of the things that I did when my mom was sick is I just wrote and I wrote stories and I interviewed my aunts about things. And I learned stories about my mom that I never knew.
I know. It is interesting what you learn, what people will tell you and you discover later. Yeah. Like, wait, I never knew that.
Yeah, I remember my dad saying, but he had a little, my mom and dad, you know, it's kind of not rags to riches because they're not rich but my dad grew up very, very poor. But he worked really hard all of his life to have everything that they had. And he had a little red sports car. And my mom would drive that car. And he said people would say they'd see this red streak going down the road. And I'm like, you're kidding me. My mom has never had a ticket in her entire life. She never had a car accident. But I learned a little bit. You know, I learned so many funny stories about her. But I would write those stories because I'm like, I want him to at least have some of that, you know, that he could know her like I knew her. So I just feel your pain in that. But, you know, Melissa, I want you to talk about one thing and then we'll talk about something extra because I think that this is good for our listeners to see too. But you had, because your mom had built this community of women and had invested herself really in women, you, after your mom's death, had a lot of women come out of the woodwork, right? And become like surrogate moms to you.
They did. And they knew all the traditions. They knew all of the things, you know, the Christmas jammies that she'd give every year. So that first year, I got like 22 pair of Christmas jammies, you know. And there is something, and that is a good reminder for me now, too, is to make sure that we're investing in our children's lives so that even when we're gone, there's a community around that can love on them. Because I was really, really blessed through that. And they are beautiful. These women put on pre-COVID, the 20th year they did it was the year right before COVID. So 2019, they would put on an annual benefit in her honor and raise money for an organization she was really passionate about called Brighter Tomorrows. And the whole thing that they would raise money for was scholarship money to train women who had been in abusive situations, abusive homes, to give them job training, interview skills training, all of that. So my mom was really big on don't just give somebody a fish, but teach them to fish and teach people to care for themselves. And so they would raise money each year. And a few hundred people every year would come to this benefit that they would put on. And it was so beautiful to see. And I did get to have my kids at the first few of those when they were born. And my daughter at the time, I guess she was probably 7, said, wow, your mommy must have been really special for all these people to come. And, but you know, to your point, I mean, Lisa, we think about as friends, right? It's so easy, especially in today's time, to have good intentions to do something, but not follow through or not really know what to do. So we just stay back and don't want to get in the way. But what I saw through those women doing that year after year after she was gone, it's just a testament to friendship and what that meant and just the authenticity of it and the commitment, the loyalty past death, you know?
Yeah, for sure. Oh, do something. We can all do something. And just, you know, I love that the Savannah's watching that.
Yeah.
She saw that too. So it's not just what those women have done in honor of your mom and continuing that mission and loving on you, but it's a way to express the love to your children, you know, Savannah, Hudson, and Olivia. So, you know, Melissa, I have to ask you, this is called Something Extra. Well, here's what I really want you to talk about. Just real quickly before we talk about that, what are you doing now?
Real quick.
What are you doing
That's
now?
Awesome, right, Lisa?
You're building community as, you know, in CEO Forum. So what are you doing? What's your mission?
Yeah, so this is where it's been fun because this is how I've gotten to know you. And it's the CEO Forum, which is a ministry that really reaches out to and serves executive leaders at the highest levels in the corporate world and all different aspects and different industries. But there is an incredible group of women that are coming up through this organization. And we've had you on the board of directors and others who've really just led the way for, I think, really this incredible new movement that's happening. And it's really fun. We're at an exciting time of growth right now. We have about 25 women who are current members and others who are looking to join. And what it is really a place to come together in community and do life together and to be served. And so that leadership journey, so often you can feel alone at the top and feeling like you really, there's no one facing the same challenges as you. Our women, we laugh, they refer to themselves as the unicorn. They said, you know, I feel like, we hear women say, I feel like I was a unicorn, the only female in the room, maybe the only person of faith here, only, you know, female. And just to be able to see that they're not alone, they said, you know, I found my other unicorns. So I'm excited and honored. This was through a mutual friend of ours too, Jim Bechtel, chief encourager. Jim knew about work that I'd done in New York, and that group had turned into planning retreats and getting women together away from the noise. That was a big thing as I prayed about what God had for these women, getting them away and into a place where they can really receive from one another and just in quiet time. And so Jim had told the leaders of the CEO Forum that he thought I would be a good fit for what was needed. So it's been fun. We're at a very exciting time. We're going to have a retreat in a couple of weeks. It's 7 weeks out in Franklin, Tennessee. There's a really cool place called South Hall, which is a new farm and inn. If you know Blackberry Farm, they are referring to this as Nashville's Blackberry Farm. And so it's just a perfect setting to see these women come together, and we're getting great response. So we do have openings to be able to invite a few special guests. So would love if any of your listeners, you know, are interested in learning more about the CEO Forum. It's theceoforum.org is our website. And then just my email is melissa@theceoforum.org. So anyway, you know, we could help connect. I think it's fun to see how people are being brought together. And I just get a sense it's for such a time as this. And so I can't wait to see what's going to happen with these women uniting and just cheering each other on. And so many of the people, Brittany Ruby Miller, you know, a couple of episodes ago, anybody listening who didn't hear that one, that is this fantastic, incredible story that she has. And it's women like that, that we can cheer each other on. And I think it's important. One thing I did learn from my mom's journey that kind of, I think deep down is a big part of my passion, is that even though she was surrounded by an incredible group of women who loved her and would have done anything for her, you know, my mom was struggling with my brother at the time and she didn't tell anyone. And I think at that generation, they couldn't let, it was almost a betrayal. If you tell somebody you're struggling with your spouse, with a child, you don't want to embarrass, you don't want to let that guard down. You feel like you need to keep that up for your family and have privacy and family things stay private. And I get that. But through counseling, I really did ask one day, what could my mom have done? Is there anything she could have done differently? And And it really, I think if she had let somebody in and said, you know, I'm scared. She did some things in the home. She hid some jewelry. She did some things that made me later realize, I think she was worried. Something like, not what happened, but maybe somebody'd come in and want money or something. And she didn't tell anyone. And so my heart is that if women who have it all together, appear to have it all together, none of us do, but if women
none of us do,
there's such importance of coming together and saying, you know what, I'm struggling and I need your prayers. I just need you to know this and to be able to allow yourself to be known and to be somebody who provides a safe space for somebody, because you have to have safe space for that. And my hope for the women of the CEO Forum is that we create a culture where it's a safe space. It's beyond networking and beyond just cheering, but really a safe space to do life together over a duration of many years. I mean, I think it could be definitely life-changing for these women, but I believe world-changing, because you change the life of a woman, you change the world.
Yeah, you know? I believe that, because you look at their children and future generations, and yeah, that is really good, Melissa. Such great advice, because I see that too, and I think vulnerability is one of those things that I think people are getting better at it, you know, and being vulnerable and really taking the mask off. But listen, I tell you what, if there is anybody out there that is saying, oh yeah, I got it all together, I don't believe it.
Yeah.
You know, because we all have stuff. My stuff looks different than yours, but we all have it. So yeah, why, you know, you creating that safe space for you to share, hey, I am struggling with this. Maybe that person's already struggled with that, you know, and has great sage advice for you. Or in a faith-based community, you know what? I'm going to be lifting you up in prayer. I mean, you and I have had situations like that where we've had a situation happen and we just right then and there, we stopped and prayed. There is power in that. So, wow. I mean, we could do a whole podcast on that. But I do have to ask you, what's the something extra, Melissa, that every leader needs?
Yeah, I think, you know, community. I think for me, it's just leaders need community. You can't do it alone. You can't go it alone. I think it's hard to find it. I think it takes work to seek it out. I think it's a process to discover it or create it. Maybe if you don't see it where you're at, maybe you create that community like that small group of women did in New York and just start doing life with people and meeting consistently and be the one that gets it going. But I think it's a fallacy to think that we can go at life alone, and the leadership journey is tough. And it is challenging. And to have people alongside you who are doing life at the level you're doing life, and to allow you to know in those, you know, those dark, challenging times that you're not alone, and to be able to pour that into somebody else and train up a new generation to live that way. I think that's really, really important. So I would say that would be the thing I would say leaders cannot live without.
Right. Community. That's a good one. Well, Melissa, this has been so much fun. This is probably the most fun thing I'll do all day long. So thank you so much.
Thank you, Lisa. So fun for me too.
It was awesome.
Thank you for listening to today's show. Something Extra with Lisa Nichols is a Technology Partners production. Copyright Technology Partners, Inc. 2019. For show notes or to reach Lisa, visit tpi.co/podcast. Don't forget to leave a review on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, or wherever you listen.